Hi, Carrie. Mr. Burt, this is Thomas Keegan, LibertarianProgressive.com, calling in.
Hello there. How are we doing tonight?
We're doing great. And, you know, we're delighted to know that you decided to spend at least part of your Friday evening here educating and informing the public about what's going on in American politics, especially Kansas District 1. When we really appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem at all. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, thanks for being on the ballot. So, you know, we have this purpose to interview you here. And also, you know, hopefully people in your district can thank you. And even if you're not in District 1 in Kansas, you know, you might be in New York, you might be in Alaska. I mean, you might find this very interesting. And so, Carrie, let's actually let people know where they can find more about you here. It's Burt, B-U-R-T, 4, F-O-R, Kansas. .com, BurtForKansas.com. And so if I may ask you just, you know, the introductory question here, have you run for office before? If so, or even if not, what inspired you to run this year? What's your approach to your campaign? And then we'll go over some of the issues later. But we appreciate you again being here for this interview this Friday night, September 30th, 2016.
Absolutely. Well, no, I'm a novice to campaigning. This will be my first ever campaign that I've ever run. Still kind of learning the ropes to it. There's a lot to it, a lot more. If you haven't ever run a campaign before, there's more to it than you can possibly imagine. I wanted to run because, I work as an aircraft mechanic. I'm part of the aviation industry, and I've seen firsthand what a government that is too involved in a particular industry does to the economy. They've regulated my industry, my work that I've loved, nearly into obsolescence. And it's tragic, and it's happening all across the nation. And the more I was paying attention to what was going on in the government, the more I could see that the more I could see that its only desire is ever to expand, to get larger, to become more powerful. And I just couldn't bear the idea of seeing what had happened to my industry continue to happen, but to happen to other people too, and to happen to people's personal lives. So, you know, I'm running with a message of smaller government, getting the government out of our industries, out of our lives, out of our businesses, so that we can feel we can be free to live our lives the way, you know, we're meant to, free. So as far as my, you know, the campaign going, you know, obviously, as is true with a lot of libertarian candidates, you know, don't have a lot of funds to work with. We're trying to run a smart social media campaign. You know, you'd mentioned my website. You can also find me at facebook.com/KB4HR. We're trying to get some good live streams going. We're trying to use the internet and modern media to spread our message, and just really wisely use the money we have. Otherwise, if you're not familiar with Kansas's first district, it's actually one of the largest districts in the United States, so it's an incredibly difficult district to campaign in. I've driven thousands of miles already just back and forth from candidate forums and debates, and I've got many, many more to go. So it's a very difficult campaign, but it's an interesting one because currently we have three people running for Congress in the first district. We have a Republican, we have an independent, and we have myself, of course, the Libertarian. So it's a really interesting race because there's no Democrat. Our incumbent Republican congressman was actually voted out during the primary. So I can honestly, I don't know of a single other race anywhere in the nation that's anything like this one. So the first is just kind of an exciting place to be, and it'll be really interesting to see what happens here come November.
Wow. And so you said you've been in some debates. If you could tell us about that, and are there any other debates coming up where it's going to be all the candidates in the debates?
Right. Well, you know, the debate, it's gone really well so far. You know, it's something I didn't have a lot of experience with. I wasn't sure exactly how it was going to go. But people are really surprisingly open to messages from third parties and from ideologies that they're not familiar with. You know, the presidential campaign this year is, you know, sucking all the oxygen out of the room politically, or at least that's what I thought. But you know, showing up to these smaller venues to you know talk to groups of 100 or less for the most part, we're really getting a lot of positive reaction. I have a lot of people coming up to me, even if they don't necessarily agree with what I have to say, who really appreciate the fact that there's a different ideology being represented. I think it's hugely encouraging, and I think that the two-party culture, not just at the very top of the political spectrum, but lower down as well, is really sort of starting to shift, and people are really opening their minds to newer ideas. It's actually really encouraging, and I'm really excited about it. I have an event coming up this weekend in Garden City, which will be way out in western Kansas. That'll be on actually be Monday. That'll you know it's very very rural. It'll be kind of different than what I've been doing so far. And then after that, I have events in Hutchinson, Kansas, Junction City, Russell, Kansas, you know, all, you know, that my whole entire district is fairly rural, so a lot of smaller farmer communities. But it'll be really exciting to see what happens, and I'm really, like I said, really interested to see what happens come November.
All right, great. And now, I did kind of get the gist of you know, your platform, the government overregulating. You do have a list of issues here at BERT4Kansas.com, and basically it says in /issues, subsidies, government spending, marriage equality, military intervention. Actually. So it's interesting what you wrote here about marriage equality. Could you explain that to our listeners, how you would approach that as an issue this season?
Sure. Well, marriage equality is something that has really been gaining ground, and I think that given enough time, the culture is going to change on this anyway. What most people don't understand about the marriage equality issue is that they're looking at it the wrong way. See, they're looking at it, well, should, you know, gay, straight, however you want to look at, have the right to marry? Should this group or that group have the right to marry? A better way to look at it is, why does the government have anything to do with marriage at all? It's a contract between two people. And, you know, the origins of the marriage equality argument actually comes from post-Civil War, where during the Jim Crow era, states would try to prevent minorities, you know, Blacks, Hispanics, Asians, from marrying whites. And so they would institute marriage licenses so that they would have a legal framework against basically to discriminate against people. And the idea that notion has carried forward into the modern era is frankly embarrassing. I don't see how this concept has any place in the modern narrative. So now the question becomes at that point, what can we actually do? And most of it has to be done at a state level. I'm a big 10th Amendment guy. We have to keep, you know, drop the power down to the states where our good, you know, small government politicians on a state level can work to deregulate stuff even further. So my idea for my focus on this is the argument that I always get when I say we need to do away with the idea of the marriage licenses. They say, but what about the tax benefits? Well, you know, if we're going to be truly all about small government, you know, we don't need to be giving out tax benefits to people just for being married. That's just all that is it's a structure around which they can build this framework of inequality. So we roll back our some of these tax incentives for marriage, something again that the government should have nothing to do with, and that'll de-incentivize states issuing marriage licenses, which can bring it back to a purely legal or religious contract. And this will actually protect everybody's rights better. It'll protect the rights of the people who simply want to engage in a civil contract, and it'll protect the rights of religious individuals who do not wish to participate in one form of marriage or another because it will not be regulated by the state.
All right. So basically, your stance is equality under the law, equal justice under the law. You know, everyone treated the same in that. And yeah, I hear exactly what you're saying there. And so hopefully no one's getting married just for tax benefits. I hope.
Well, I like
So
to think not.
I'd like to think not. Yeah, there might be one or two out there, but yeah, I don't think most people are. Now, what about subsidies? Yeah, there's a lot of subsidies, and that's another issue about equality under the law, isn't it? And very much principally, I guess you could say some of the same ways. I mean, not everyone's getting equal subsidies. So what does Carrie Burt, how do you approach government subsidies?
Well, you know, again, the problem with subsidies is we tend to look at it in the wrong way. So many things are just a matter of optics and perspective. The problem with subsidies is that they've been built to us as, look, this group is in need, we need to help them. And being naturally charitable, we think to ourselves, yes, I want to help them. But there's another way to look at this. The proper way to look at this is that the government is looking at you, the work that you have done, the sweat that you have put out, and saying, good work, but this group deserves the money that you worked for just a little bit more. So we're going to take it from you, and we're going to give it out to somebody else. And this is infuriating to me personally, because we end up with protected groups. We end up with protected industries who are deemed too critical to not get extra money from government. In my own race, you know, if I lose for anything, I'm sure it'll be this, but, you know, I stand against farm subsidies. There's no reason that we should look at a baker or a fisherman or an aircraft mechanic, any other industry, and say, good work, but we need to take your money and give it to these people because they're just, what they do is just more important than what you do. It's morally and ethically wrong. And industries become dependent on it. A subsidy is a lot like a regulation in the sense that when it's in place for long enough, then that industry will build around it, and it'll develop around it. And what can't grow organically or holistically the way the economy is meant to grow, the way industries are meant to grow, and so you end up with a structure that becomes self-supporting. So Even some of these subsidies that were originally put in place to as temporary means of supporting, you know, industries that were in distress, the farm bill and some of the farm subsidies that exist come about as a direct result of some of the failures of the North American Free Trade Agreement. So I think that anyone who passed those subsidies when they eventually came out would have looked at them and said, you know, these are never meant to be ongoing. They're going to go to a certain point. When the problem's solved, they end. Well, they never actually end because the industry grows around those subsidies. So if we really want to have a truly free market, if we really want to have a healthy industry, then we simply have to get rid of these subsidies. It'll be hard, but, a little short-term pain is a lot better than perpetuating what is, you know, really a terminal cancer on our free market economy.
Gary, when you said, that growing organically, that just gave me a picture in my mind, I have to admit here. So I kind of see what you're saying here. If I had a garden and I had a plant and I had some, like, weeds growing around it, you know, and if I kept fertilizing the tomato plants, I'm kind of subsidizing that tomato plant. And if I kept pulling out the weeds around it and never gave them anything, it's kind of like treating the rest of us as weeds and treating certain groups as like that tomato plant that I want to grow. Now, that might be fine for my own garden, you know, because I can, you know, I'm purposely growing that. But when you're talking about a public institution that's supposed to treat everyone equally, you can obviously see that's not fair. Now, I do appreciate you being honest, saying like that could be the issue that, that you could potentially lose on. But so let's be fair about it, though. So if you're willing to say that, there has to be something overarching that you feel strongly about that, because there's pros and cons, I guess, to everything. So if that's a con, if it is, what are some of the pros? What would be the over, you know, the bigger picture where everyone would benefit, more so than they would not benefit from losing some subsidies potentially?
Well, the biggest gain that I can see is if we stop perpetuating things going the exact same way they always have, because that's what it is, when we subsidize failure, we ensure that that's the only outcome we'll ever get. We don't encourage innovation. We don't do anything like that. So an industry will end up stagnating. It'll stay the same. We won't see any big advances because people aren't going to take risks to do things differently when they know they can continue to do the same thing, fail, and get paid for it anyway, right? That's not a critique of farmers or a member of any particular industry, because it's just smart business. If it's set up that way already, you can fight the tide and lose because you're playing against a different set of rules than everybody else's, or you can take advantage of the structure that exists. So I'm not saying that it makes anybody a bad person or that it necessarily makes anybody less on a moral high ground than anyone else. But it does create a framework where there's no real desire for innovation. But the innovations are out there. We can be doing things differently. There are fantastic technologies out there today with GPS, hydroponics, aquaponics, farming just as an example. There are entirely different ways that we could be doing it, but we're not doing it those ways. I keep telling people about this awesome thing we have. We just had a new hydroponics garden. It's actually an aquaponics garden open in our town, and they're doing it. They're raising food year round in an indoor facility that is a completely closed loop system that's self-supporting, and they're hugely successful and outside of the normal mainstream system. They're not necessarily getting the subsidies. They're not necessarily benefiting from these. And they're doing it in a completely different way because they've taken themselves outside the normal structure. And if we can do that, if we can get people, if we can get people off of the government, we can get them off, because it's like a drug. You get hooked on it. And then you need it. That's what a subsidy is. It just breeds necessity. If we can get people off of that, then we can get them to doing different things. And I believe that here in America, people have the spirit of innovation. And I believe that if we simply let them loose, they will innovate in ways that, we may not even be able to imagine.
So what does freedom mean to you? I mean, this is, I guess, just a very general question here. It means something to everyone. I mean, more to you personally. I mean, what is your story of freedom? What does it mean to you in day-to-day life? What does it mean to your community? Why is freedom so important?
Well, freedom is about personal responsibility more than anything else. It's about understanding that nobody's going to do it for you, that you have to do it yourself. On the other hand, it's about understanding that nobody is going to hinder you from doing it. So, this is what I've been telling people as I go through the campaign trail. And again, I don't know if it's a message that people like to hear, but I tell them, if you have a problem with homelessness in your community, if you have a problem with drug addiction, if you have a problem with failing infrastructure, that's not the government's problem. That's your problem. You as a citizen, it is your problem. Because if we're really going to sit here and say, I want to be free. I want freedom. I want the government out of it. Then we have to fill the gap. We have to be the ones who, if we see the homeless guy out there on the corner, we can't be the ones who say, government's going to take care of it. We have to take the initiative and go out and take care of it. If we know that the drug addiction is a problem, instead of saying, the cops will go pick that junkie up, we need to be the ones who have the compassion to say, no, we are going to deal with that. We're going to try to help those people. And sometimes that'll mean going into uncomfortable situations. And sometimes there will be people we can't help. And there will be situations that we can't help. But it's about having the personal responsibility to know that we have to try. That's a part of freedom that I think gets missed a lot. People talk, well, it's about me being able to succeed. It's about me doing this. It's about me doing that. But it's also about us taking responsibility for our communities and for each other, because we're asking ourselves and our fellow citizens to fill a role that has been filled by government for far too long.
Yeah, if you take up, I mean, I've done the math before, and I don't have articles all prepared in front of me, but if you take up all the government contracts, federal and states, and added them all up, I mean, it's a huge percentage of, you know, how much is spent publicly every single year after year after year. And it's going to some people, and it's not going to others. Now, some might say that it benefits everyone, but it does not benefit everyone equally. Let me ask you specifically, in 2008, you know, there was that financial crash. Some people call it the Great Recession. And, you know, a lot of industries were bailed out. You know, and there's lots of examples, like you said, for NAFTA. Some people were, you know, the legislators who passed NAFTA wanted to, you know, I guess they were trying to be considerate of some industries that might be affected, so they gave them some subsidies. But now people are talking about, what if there's another recession coming up, or there's some other bank failures that they might, what would happen if they needed to be bailed out again? So if you were elected as Kansas's district number one representative to the U.S. House, and let's say some big financial institutions, some big insurance companies, they're too big to fail. I mean, it would be widespread, you know, systematic panic. You know, would you vote to bail them out, per se?
No. No, I would not. I don't think that that's healthy for a free market economy. If a business is making poor decisions, it doesn't care what kind. I don't care if it's a bank. I don't care if it's a car company. I don't care if it's the mortgage. I don't care what it is. Then they're creating a situation for themselves that is leading them to failure. And you know, and to be fair, you know, some of this, you know, the banking bailout came about as partially a result of actions taken by the Federal Reserve. I mean, largely because of actions taken by the Federal Reserve. Again, interaction from the government, well, in this case, a non-governmental private organization, that causes a industry to grow in an unhealthy manner. But the way I like to look at this is, let's go back to the garden analogy. If you simply replant the same plants every year that are from the same genetic strain, that'll work for a while, until a disease comes through that those plants never had an opportunity to build resistance to. They don't have the genetic resistance built in, and they'll all be wiped out. That's what happened during the Irish potato famine. They kept planting the same seed potatoes over and over and over again, and then, you know, a fungal disease came through and it killed everybody out, and almost everybody in Ireland starved to death. That's what we're doing with our industries, is we're just replanting the same things again. We're not giving them the opportunity to build resistances. So what you do instead is you plant different strains. You let them develop. Some of them will die off. Some of them won't. But the ones that do survive will be strong because they figured out how to weather the storms. They figured out what works and what doesn't. Because if all you do is you keep bailing out the same gigantic industries over and over again because they're too big to fail, all you do is you send them a message that no matter how badly they screw up, it'll be fine because Uncle Sam will jump in and rescue them. So you're going to continue perpetuating the problem. Maybe not that same specific problem, but you'll perpetuate the idea that if they do something stupid, it's fine. You don't want to do this. That's why our economy continues to go into recession, and each one tends to be worse than the last, is because they find some new stupid thing to do that sinks the country into a recession. We need to back this off.
Yeah, and it's really not fair to, like, let's say those some of those companies, you know, did suffer the consequences, and you know, what about the up and coming, you know, mid-sized banks that didn't need the bailouts? You know, they probably would have bought up the big banks or the pieces of them and restructured them, and they didn't make the bad decisions. So it's really not fair to them, I guess you could argue, because they would now be the big banks and they might be smarter, actually, and we might be in a lot better situation. But instead, their competition got bailed out and they're still mid-sized, while the other ones are still too big to fail, even bigger to fail. And, you know, or if I was a salesperson working at a car dealership and I kept, you know, being number one in sales every week, but if my buddy who wasn't so good at sales kept getting bailed out, you know, I mean, that would probably get on my nerves, you know, but now let's move to government spending. You had something called the penny plan. So this sounds pretty practical. I mean, you know, we got into a little bit of the philosophy there and some practicality, but yeah, can you tell us about your advocating here?
Right. Well, I'd love to take credit for this, but the fact is that I shamelessly stole it from people smarter than myself. So basically what the penny plan is we agree that we're going to cut 1 cent out of every dollar of federal spending across the board. Now, the great thing about this plan is you're going to get a ton of pushback on this thing, because the argument always is, well, this program is vital. We can't cut here. Fine, we won't cut there. But for every dollar we don't cut there, we cut 2 cents somewhere else. So we end up cutting the same amount of money across the board. It just can be distributed however we want. So, you know, we end up creating a situation where nobody can say, you know, well, this pet project of mine has to be saved. But if you end up having people who are trying to, you know, push the issue saying, well, we can't cut this or that, you know, the other individuals in Congress and the Senate are going to look at it and look at that individual and say, well, if we don't cut from your program, then you're going to be cutting into our program. So there's not going to be a big incentive for people to want to fight this, because they're just going to make themselves the enemy of everybody else in Congress. I really feel like this is a good plan, because it's a plan that everybody in America can understand. You know, the issue, I think, with a lot of our spending plans is that they end up being hugely complicated, overly complex. You try to explain them to the American people, they can't understand them. And now my dad was really fond of saying that if you can't understand a deal, that means you're getting screwed. Well, all of these spending plans that keep coming down the pipe, they end up being hugely complex, thousands of pages long, nobody can understand them. And the reason nobody can understand them is because, you know, the people in power don't want you to know that you are, in fact, getting screwed, that this, you know, isn't actually doing what its bill is doing. You know, we have people on Capitol Hill right now saying that, well, you know, there's no possible way we could ever cut any sort of defense funding, even though we know that that's rubbish, that recently $8 billion simply disappeared. Nobody has any idea why it's there. And for some reason, we can't audit the Defense Department despite this. You know, we understand that there's huge waste in among social programs. Across the board, we've become far too careless in our spending. And this plan lets the American people see that there is a simple way of going about this. And what's even better about this is there's no way that you can logically resist it and not seem like an imbecile, because there's no reasonable way, and there's no way that the American people will tolerate it if one of their elected officials comes up and says, no, there's no physical way that I can cut one penny out of a dollar of federal spending for my project. So there's a lot of incentive for people to cooperate with this. I think it's a good plan. I think it's a plan that'll work. And best of all, it's a plan that people can understand.
Kerry, I think it I've never heard of this penny plan before, but it does seem very interesting. It says here analysts have demonstrated that this plan would reduce spending by $7.5 trillion over the course of 10 years. Now, we're about $19 to $20 trillion in debt right now. So basically, the penny plan, let me just start out with this. I mean, anyone that's been listening up to this point, again, we're talking with Kerry Burt, BurtForKansas.com, BurtForKansas.com, and he's running as a Libertarian for the 1st District of Kansas, as a Libertarian on the ticket here for the U.S. Congress. He's going to be on the ballot November 8th, 2016, about 39 days away, and so, you know, a lot of people might be a Libertarian. You're just going to cut everything. People are going to be on the streets. But that's, you know, you're talking about more freedom here. And actually, I would say this is very, very mainstream, very moderate. I mean, you're talking about one penny. I mean, it's a huge compromise. One penny for every dollar. you know, I would almost say you could, if you cut 3 pennies out of every dollar, we'd be out of debt in 10 years. I mean, if one penny would cut $7.5 trillion and we're $20 trillion in debt, we could be out of debt and have a, you know, a completely balanced budget in 10 years. But I think I would be happy in the trajectory of just one penny out of every dollar over the next 10 years. And let's just see where we are in those 10 years. I mean, it seems very moderate. It seems like, you know, you're not going to be putting people on the streets. You're not going to be, you know, just like toppling over everything. I mean, it seems very moderate, actually.
Exactly. It allows us to roll things back slowly because, you know, you hear a lot of these plans where people come up with saying, you know, we're going to cut this department and this department and this department just immediately. And the problem with just immediately cutting something out is that it creates a vacuum. And, you know, like I said, industries, you know, people's lives have evolved around these government programs. While I would love to see them gone tomorrow, you know, I understand that to a certain degree, we're going to have to wean people off of this stuff. You know, I'm not an uncompassionate person, and I don't want to see anybody on the streets, you know, but I do want to see our country move in a more positive direction.
Yeah, another garden analogy. You don't want to get plant shock, you know? So.
Well, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. And so now let's I'm saving this one issue here, I guess, for last, not on purpose, but it just happens to be military intervention. But I think this is, a very core issue here. And so, yeah, please tell us about the issue of military intervention, sir.
Right. And in one way, this ties in with everything else we've talked about. Obviously, you know, the endless wars, police actions, interventionism that we've been involved with has been hugely expensive. I mean, tragically expensive. And I think on some level, it's a little bit horrifying the way the politicians will spin this so that any individual who is opposed to us being involved in every single place in the world militarily is painted as unpatriotic or somehow vilifying America. What I think is unpatriotic is the idea that we would spend trillions of dollars in countries engaged in military actions that do nothing but leave them in more chaos and leave them a worse place than what we came. That's not our job, and it's certainly not what we should aspire to. Just look at Syria, Libya, Yemen to a lesser extent. In one way or another, we've contributed to those disasters. Iraq has gone from being, you know, ruled by a brutal dictator to seemingly a place where freedom might take root to being ruled by nothing but chaos. We're not improving these places. I'm going to speak specifically to the Middle East because I think that's what we can all connect with the most. We've been involved in the Middle East in one capacity or another since the Cold War, since we started, you know, arming Afghanis to fight the Soviets, and that eventual, and you know, one of those Afghanis being Osama bin Laden. But our chickens have come home to roost on this. Decades of failed policy in the Middle East have led to where we are now. Trillions of dollars spent, countless lives ruined, Americans dead and for wars that we don't even understand. It's time to admit that we have no idea what the hell we're doing in the Middle East. We don't understand the culture there. We don't understand anything about the place, and it's time to stop trying to cram freedom down their throat, because freedom is something that you have to arrive at yourself. You know, the Americans fought a bloody revolution for freedom. Nobody came and gave it to us. You can't simply give somebody freedom. Freedom has to be something that you discover yourself. This is pretty personal for me, too, because my brother serves in the armed forces. He's an airborne medic stationed in Anchorage, Alaska. And I hear these politicians in both parties talking about, well, we need boots in the ground in Syria. We need boots in the ground in Libya here and there. Well, you know, that's all well and good. But my brother's in two of those boots, and I have no interest in him being killed in some desert hellhole because some politician needed to pick up some votes. I'm not interested in that. And I sure as hell am not interested in him being killed because the Saudis wanted to make it a little bit easier to ship oil from one place to another. That's another issue that runs tangential to the issue of militarization around the world, is this idiotic policy of we're going to sell weapons to just whoever asks for them. But we just signed a multi-billion dollar deal to give weapons to the Saudis that they're going to use to continue terrorizing the country of Yemen. You want to talk about a forgotten war? Talk about Yemen. That place is being obliterated in large part by the Saudis. It's every bit as terrible as the scenes that we see coming out of Aleppo. But, you know, we simply let it go by, and I'm not sure I understand exactly why we continue to put up with it. But America needs to get out of this mindset of we're always going to be at war. I understand that September 11th was a terrible thing, and we should never forget what happened. We should always be vigilant, but we've allowed it to shape every single part of our lives. We've given up our Fourth Amendment rights. We've given up, you know, our right to peace. We've embroiled ourselves in continuous war every day of our lives since then. And it's time to slow down, stop, and just think for a moment that maybe there's another way, that maybe just because something terrible happened to us more than a decade ago doesn't mean that we need to put our entire future at risk. Because if that happens, the people who attacked us on September 11th, then they've won. Then they have won. So I'm not willing to surrender to those people. I'm not willing to surrender to politicians who tell me that my rights are secondary to somebody else's bloodlust.
Wow. So in summary here, I mean, this is, you talked about, we start out with the principle of marriage equality, and that could be any subject. It's really about equality under the law. And we talked about subsidies, a level playing field, entrepreneurship, the free market per se, a real free market, not crony capitalism, but just the opposite. Why people emigrate here to start up their own and to make it or not make it on their own. And just, that same spirit that was in the Wild West, the same spirit that people came here without any guarantees, but every possibility of an opportunity. And then we move to government spending, where it's very moderate, one penny. It's the penny plan. You don't have to be a libertarian to get behind that. I mean, you could be a Republican, a Democrat, Green Party candidate. I think almost anyone could see logic, like you said, in the penny plan and the military intervention. And, I think you said that very, very well.
There's something, a follow-up question I had with that.
So let me put on my neoconservative hat, my cynical neo, rhino hat on for a second. My Bill Kristol, Dick Cheney hat here. Iraq, the Middle East is in America's strategic interests. Our military uses a lot of oil every single day. In fact, more than some small countries, actually. And so if we don't secure those oil fields, and this has nothing, of course, to do with, freedoms for other countries. I mean, it's all strategic, and there's so many businesses invested in that section. So what say you about that? And I'm sure you have a good answer, but, let me just ask that to you, because maybe some people wouldn't ask it that way. And I know that sounds cynical, but I bet some people do think that. How would you respond to that question?
Sure. Well, first off, I reject that premise. The fact is that between the Alaskan oil fields and in amongst the Aleutian Islands and the Canadian oil sands, between those two, there's actually more oil than there is in all of Saudi Arabia. America is leading the way in innovations when it comes to accessing oil that was previously unacceptable. Unaccessible, rather, with horizontal drilling, hydraulic fracturing, You want to talk about why gas prices plummeted a few, you know, just a few, just, well, it's been about a year now. They plummeted because suddenly we could access oil that we'd never dreamed of accessing before. This, the technology didn't exist to get to. Well, now we can get to it. And the Middle Eastern countries, you know, Saudi Arabia in particular, but all of the OPEC countries had to scramble to push their prices down to the point that they were actually losing money on oil, simply to try to put American oil companies out of business so that they couldn't afford to do any further exploration. That is a good place to be from a market standpoint. That tells me that we can provide our own oil. We can provide our own resources. We don't need these. We don't need to be going to these horribly volatile regions and doing business with people with horrible human rights records, and essentially acting as the military of the royal family of Saud, simply so we can access their oil, because we have our own oil. And you know, and there's another aspect to this too. We're fighting and dying and killing and destroying for a technology that is on its way out. You can see every day I read stories about how we are moving closer and closer to a time when oil simply won't be as necessary as it is now. You know, our oil consumption, Europe's oil consumption has actually gone down over the last decade. And the United States isn't quite there yet, but it's on its way. You know, the advent of more, the obvious is electrical technology with
like
electrical motors powering, Tesla, exactly. We have these private innovators who are coming up with fantastic technology that is making it less and less necessary. You know, we're going to need fewer petroleum products in the future for things like plastic. You know, I have to tell you, as a libertarian, you know, that hemp can be used to make plastics. There are various other chemical compounds that are being experimented with right now that can be used to make things that are superior to plastics. You know, oil is simply not the technology of the future. It's the technology of now, and that's fine for now. But for us to bleed and die and destroy all across the world to maintain a status quo technologically is frankly a waste.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, in that cynical point of view, you know, that's a waste of subsidization. It's a holding us back. Just another example. So, Kerry, we appreciate very much you spending the time with us, sharing your views. Very, very interesting interview here and enlightening. So let me ask you this. I ask everyone this here, and I just, you know, it's just a common question I like to ask people. Who's some of your favorite people, past or present, elected or not?
Well, I've been telling people who've asked me that so far. If I, my favorite historical figure would be Calvin Coolidge from a political perspective. You know, take a guy who can come reduce national debt, who can roll back spending, roll back government involvement, and not leave the country a total mess. And that guy is always going to be my hero every day. I really have looked up to him. I've been reading a lot lately on some of the founders of the country, and I found a lot both to look up to and to give me sort of cautionary tales about people like, you know, George Washington and Benjamin Franklin and James Joy. And I've been finding a lot of little bits and pieces of some of those people to kind of inspire me. It's tough though. I suppose you've heard Gary Johnson's latest issues with trying to find a world leader who he looks up to. And as a libertarian, finding a leader to look up to is sort of tough because throughout history, most of them, more of them than not, have been big government people. You know, more of them than not have made more mistakes than not. And so a lot of them that I find kind of inspiring are really more cautionary tales than anything else. It's a difficult thing as a libertarian sometimes to look back through history and find people to really look up to.
Sure, and that was been in the news lately. I watched the entire Hardball Chris Matthews town hall. It was totally taken out of context. I mean, people play 10 seconds of a clip, but if anyone decides to watch the full hour, 45 minutes, I mean, there's a lot more substance than that 10-second clip, you know. Well, Kerry, it's been a pleasure, and good luck in your campaign. Again, thank you for taking time out here to talk with us and to explain your candidacy and your principles to our audience. It's been very informative, and this is going to be rebroadcast at libertarianprogressive.com, where you'll see all our interviews. So we encourage you to, you know, look at them and share them with people. And thank you so much. It's been a good interview here, and I hope you have a good weekend. And thanks again. We appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right. Oh, and let me just say, any final words before we go here, sir?
Oh, just get out and vote, everybody. Even if you're not excited about the presidential campaign, get out and vote down ballot. You know, the presidential campaign is a disaster. It's a sideshow. But there are good people around the country running for Congress. And if you're terrified about the idea of who's going to be president, just remember that there is a balance of power. The executive sometimes forgets this, but there is a balance of power. And if you get good people in Congress, good people in the Senate, then you can counteract much of what goes on in the executive branch.
All right. Bert4KansasBurt.com. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.